So we're at the last day of this meditation retreat, and as you all know, just how fast these things go. And for those of you who feel sad that the retreat is now over or soon to be over, don't worry, just like this retreat went very fast, the time until the next retreat also goes very fast. And that's life, it just goes very fast. But one of the things which I would like to point out for this retreat, for each one of you, is that because this method of letting go is so very powerful, even though you haven't let go fully yet, there does come the time that when, because of these teachings, because of your training, because of what you've done in this retreat, you actually do let go. It's almost as if that this is brainwashing you, conditioning you, putting in these suggestions and methods deep into your mind, so that one day you're meditating and you do know what to do. You do know how to let go. You do, as I say, press the letting go button. And the point with the path of Buddhism is really you only have to let go big time once to actually to see what's possible. You only need that one experience. So many, many days of meditation, many meditation retreats, it's all worthwhile if for that one time you really let go and go into these incredibly deep, peaceful, blissful states of mind called the jhanas. Because those experiences will stay there with you forever. And this will be like a gold mine of insight. It is in those deep and powerful experiences where you see the nature of things from a perspective which ordinary people just cannot see. And that gives you the what I call the data by which you can get enlightenment experiences. So we're not here as Buddhists just to get peaceful or just to let go of the stress of our work or to become healthy or to get powerful deep states of mind. We're here for enlightenment, to get liberated. And this is the way it is done. It's the way it's been done since the time of the Buddha. People getting into these deep meditations and seeing things which they've never seen before, and thereby awakening to the truth of things. So never get disappointed that you never got into fourth jhana on this retreat, only third jhana. Never get disappointed, because you've made a lot of progress, you've done the best you possibly can do, and it is only a matter of time before these things happen. The Buddha gave the simile of the water jar. It's one of the famous similes of Buddhism. Imagine a water jar bigger than your height. Because it's so big, you don't know how empty it is or how full it is. So all you can do is put another cup of water into that jar, and then another cup. You don't know how many cups are needed to fill that jar, but you can always put one more cup in. And you know that if you keep putting one more cup of water in that jar, it's only a matter of time before that water jar is full and overflows. And this is the same as one's meditation practice. All one can do is just to have another sitting meditation, another walking period of meditation. All you can do is keep making peace, being kind, being gentle. That's all you can do. And that means every time you're putting another cup of water into the big water jar. And you know, but you don't know when, that one day that water jar will be full and it will overflow. Which is why it happens. One day you go and sit down and it's like an ordinary meditation. And without expectation, without any warning, you get into a very deep and powerful state of mind. The water jar has overflown. That's basically how it works. So you don't know when. But however, even I say this, that people still, at the end of this retreat, will start judging themselves and start saying, well, in this retreat, how did I do? And you might start talking with your friends. How did you do? And your friend says, I got a beautiful nimitta, and you get really disappointed because you got nothing. That's unfair. That's what happens when you start measuring and comparing. And this is another part of meditation which I haven't shared with you yet, but it's a good time to share it. At the end of the retreat, please understand that all measuring and all comparing are all delusion, stupidity, conducive to suffering. You can't measure yourself with other people. Indeed, that I developed a meditation procedure which understands the problem caused by measuring and goes in a different direction. Because when you stop measuring, it means you cannot control. Many years ago, one of the disciples in Perth, knowing that I was a scientist by training before I became a monk, asked me to comment on a statement by the British engineer, scientist and philosopher Lord Kelvin. And for those of you who remember your science, Kelvin was the man who gave his name to the absolute scale of temperature, starting at -273 degrees centigrade, that's 0 degrees Kelvin. So he was a very famous physicist and also philosopher of science, one of the people who started the Industrial Revolution in Europe. And one of his insights was, if we are to control nature, we have to learn how to measure her accurately first of all. Because before we could have technology, we have to have accurate measurements of extension, weight, temperature. So without those measurements, we couldn't have our progress we see today. So he and many other people set out developing standard measurements as the foundation for our modern day technology. But when they asked me that question about what do you think about, in order to control nature, we have to have measurements first of all, I straight away turned that statement around to, if we don't measure things, it means we cannot control. If we don't measure, we have to let go. So realizing that, I developed a meditation of no measuring. And what that really means, that when you sit down and close your eyes and you go into the present moment, you don't measure at all or compare that this moment is better than the last or worse than the last. This is my best meditation, worst meditation, or somewhere in between. One doesn't measure at all. One does not compare. Now, when you don't measure and you don't compare your meditation, you find that you have no possibility of controlling it, of making it better, because you have no concept of better or worse. You don't make it more still, because you let go of even that measuring. How still is my mind? You don't have to worry about, is my mind dull or is it alert? Because you don't measure even that part of your mind. You totally give up all measuring and all comparison and all judging. Now if you try that, it's great fun. As soon as you try and have a measuring scale of bliss or frustration at the other end of that scale, just you give that away straight away. And because you've got no scale of measurement in your mind, because you don't even try to judge, it means you can do absolutely nothing. It means you cannot control. You've got no means of control. And the result of that is you let go. And you become really, really peaceful. Now, when I first started talking about that, one of the monks said, "Ajahn Brahm, that's really amazing. We always thought you were Mahayana, because that's just the same as the third Zen patriarch's teaching. The path is easy for those without preferences." For those of you who know that very famous verse, "The path is easy when you have no preferences." when you have no measuring, when you don't judge. Now you try that. You sit there, I'm not going to judge, no preference, being sleepy, being alert, being frustrated, being at peace. When you don't judge, it means you cannot do anything. And this doing things, as I've kept on telling you from the start of this retreat, that is our problem. That is our mara. I don't know how many of you know enough about Buddhism to know that mara, the tempter, this is the bad guy of Buddhism. This is the one which stops people getting enlightened. That mara is a deva, a heavenly being, who lives in one of the highest heaven realms, the Paranimitta Vasavati realm. And for those of you who don't know that Pali, it means the realm of devas who wield control over others. In other words, mara is the biggest control freak in the universe. And that's why if you try and let go of control, mara really gets pissed off. And he tries to come and make you control, make you afraid, tempt you, whatever it is, to try and get you to do something to stop you being peaceful and getting out of samsara. Mara is the big control freak. And he wants you to control as well, so you don't escape from samsara. So when you stop measuring things, all you do, I know you, Mara, that's enough. You don't need to control Mara, you don't need to beat him up, you don't need to send him on his way. Just to know is enough. And that's in your meditation, just to know without controlling or trying to change or measure things. If you understand that, you understand how this path of meditation works. You really let go and everything happens, peace, tranquility, watching the beautiful breath, delightful breath, jhanas, the whole works, when you stop controlling, when you stop making, when you stop generating more sankharas, karmic formations. So that's a great meditation, especially at the end of the retreat. So at the end of the retreat, if someone says, how did you go? Was this a good retreat or a bad retreat? You can say, dunno. Did you have nice meditation or bad meditation? No measuring. Now straight away that takes away a lot of pride and a lot of disappointment. It takes away much of the defilements which create problems in our world. And not only that, because you don't measure, it gives you contentment. This is good enough. I am good enough. I am at peace. Doesn't matter what I've attained, what I've not attained, I'm not going to measure it. Therefore, I am at peace. At school, you might get report cards, but I promise you, I will not hand out report cards at 3 p.m. I will not give you an A, B, C, D, E, or F. And as you know, for those of you who've seen me in interviews, have I ever criticized you? Have I ever told you, you stupid meditator? And all my life as a teacher, I've never had anyone as dumb as you. Instead, even though you say some dumb things, I always say, very good, yes. And I do that because I'm not going to measure you. And you should not measure yourself. Because all measuring is a way of controlling. If I say you're a sinner, you're a bad person, then I can start controlling you. When you don't judge, all control disappears. And in its place, you get this wonderful sense of freedom and peace. Nibbana. But I wanted to mention in this last talk a couple of things which is just tying up some loose ends. Things which I should have said but didn't get around to saying. Many of you in interviews, when you do stop measuring, when you do start to let go, when you stop controlling, sometimes you have interesting physical feelings. In particular, Sometimes when you're meditating, people think they're swaying, or they're nodding, or they're flying up into the ceiling, or their body is expanding, getting fatter and fatter, or they're falling into the floor. It's amazing the amount of feelings you can have in the body during meditation, which are not real. Well, they're real in one sense. You're perceiving these things, but they're not actually happening. I remember one meditator a long time ago said she was always swaying in her meditation. So in one sitting, I decided to keep my eyes open and watch her. And she was perfectly still. And I told her afterwards, said, no, I was swaying. I said, no, you were still. She said, I was swaying, I was watching. And I said, next time I'll get video camera to prove it to you. So even though it feels like your body is moving, a lot of the times it isn't. That's just the nature of perception. When the mind gets still, all of the restrictions on your perception get taken away, and you can see weird things. This happens in meditation, because what we call perception, the way you see things, has been trained, it's been conditioned. Now, if you're a Chinese Malaysian, you see things slightly different than an Australian Angmo, who sees it slightly different than an African from Nigeria. Because of our training, we perceive things slightly differently. You all know that story of the Eskimos, the Inuits, who can notice 7 different types of snow. For us, it's just snow. Because our perception is trained from the time we're very young. In other words, we're taught how to see things in one particular way. Now, when you get to this certain state of meditation, all those restrictions are removed. And so you can see things in strange ways, in weird ways. Now, for me, I love weird experiences. I'm not afraid of them. I just know exactly what they are. They're just perception, having fun. And to give you some examples, one of the first times it's happened, when I was a young monk in Thailand, and I was going past the washing area, a well with some water jars, and I noticed that one of the monks had bathed earlier and hung up his towel to dry. But his towel was black, was jet black. And I've never seen a black towel before in my life. Even if you go to the stores in Penang, you see red towels, pink towels, yellow towels, white towels. But have you ever seen a black towel being sold in the shops? If any of you want to start a new fashion chain, black towels, no one's done that yet. You can get a niche in the market. Black towels are cool because you don't need to wash them so much. But anyhow, I'd never seen a black towel before, ever, and there was one hanging on the line. And so I stared at it, not just glanced at it, but stared at it for about 2 or 3 minutes, thinking, where did this come from? Who owns a black towel? I've never seen one before. And after about 2 or 3 minutes, then the colour changed to white again. And I thought, am I going crazy? Because it was black and now it's white. That was one of the first times I realized how perception, the way we interpret things like sight or sound or feelings in our brain, in our mind, is conditioned. And when you get to a certain state of meditation, all that condition is taken away and you start to see things in totally different ways. Sometimes you're looking at a person and then you don't see them as a person anymore. You see them as skeleton, just bones with no skin on top of it. And people think, my goodness, I'm going crazy. You aren't going crazy. This is totally normal for a meditator. All it is your perception is becoming freed. And another experience which I like to share with meditators, because this might happen to you one day, and if it does, it is fun. I saw a monster, a demon. I was sitting meditation, and instead of the usual nimittas coming up, there was this face of a monster
with his tongue hanging out. And big eyes, like as if the eyes were going to fall out, red. And his mouth, you saw his mouth, they weren't like ordinary teeth, they were fangs, dripping red blood. And had a skull of necklaces, a necklace of skulls around its neck. And that was a giveaway. As soon as I saw the necklace of skulls, I thought, no, that is so ordinary. There's nothing special about this demon. And I remember this is what I'd seen in the temple drawings or in the paintings. I realized it was just my perception playing around. So there was this demon trying to scare me. And when I realized it was just perception creating some fun and games, I said, I'm going to join in, I'm going to play. But the first thing I did was put a pair of sunglasses, a pair of Ray-Bans over its goggly eyes. So it looked really a cool demon with sunglasses on. And then, just like I used to do as a naughty school kid, you know, to black out a few teeth so the demon looked like it needed to go to the dentist. And then I put a cigarette out of its mouth. And I put a straw hat over its head until this demon looked so ridiculous, so stupid. In my meditation, I laughed, and the demon, humiliated, went away, never came back again, ever. Now, because I knew these were creations in my mind, I could actually play around with them, and I did have fun with them. And this was not just my own experience, because some years later, there was a young man came to meditate in my monastery in Australia. And one day he came to see me after breakfast. He was really concerned because as he was walking around our monastery, when he saw like a paving stone or a paving brick, he looked down and these demons would come out of the brick at him. And so, you know, he thought he was going crazy. He thought he was going mad. And I told him my story and I said, play with them. And straight away, he got the message. And 24 hours later, he said, I had the most wonderful day. I was playing with all these demons, making them look absolutely stupid, putting big red noses on their face. And I said, have a really fun day. And so mid-afternoon, they all disappeared. They had enough of me. And he understood just how these things only have the power you give them. They're just creations of the mind. They're not real. And you play with them. Have fun. So don't be so serious when these things come up. They have no power over you whatsoever because they're creations of your mind. It's just perception. So from that time on, if you have any weird things happen in the mind, enjoy. It's like better than sci-fi. You can get much better special effects in your mind than Steven Spielberg could ever manufacture. So enjoy and have fun if those things happen. It happens at that certain stage of meditation when you're letting go enough so all of the constraints on this thing you call perception can be taken away. And from that you gain the insights that the way you look at things has been just so conditioned into you. The way that boys look at girls, girls look at boys, you look at monks, you look at old age, you look at many things. We've just been taught how to see it in one way. And when perception gets wider, you can see it in so many different ways. It gives you far more freedom. But another thing happens at this particular stage in meditation when you start to let go. It's not just that you perceive your body is moving this way or that way, but sometimes your body does move in weird ways. A few people have told me that their head has been turning around or that their head has gone to one side. And they should they turn their head back up again, should they straighten their head. Sometimes they slump, should they straighten up. Sometimes they're straight, should they slump. And the answer is, don't do anything. Because I told a few of you in your interviews, there was one retreat which I was giving. And I opened my eyes towards the end of the meditation period. And there was one lady, I've never seen anyone sit meditation in such a painful posture. She was twisted around like sort of some autistic child. And when I saw it, I was really concerned for her because she'd been sitting like that for quite a long time. So the first opportunity, I asked her, I said, "You know how you were sitting? I can't do it. I can't stretch and put my body in such an uncomfortable position. You break your spine or something." But she was in that really strange position. And when I asked her afterwards, I said, "How do you feel?" She said, "That was such a wonderful meditation. I felt so relaxed. All the aches and pains in my body are gone." I thought, how can that be? Do you know how you were sitting? She didn't know. But then when I asked her, how come that was the case? Then she started talking to me about some accident where she injured her spine. And from that time on I realized, your body is incredibly smart. In meditation, when you give it some freedom, when you stop controlling it, when your body is no longer your slave, but you give it some freedom, then the body will move to where it thinks it needs to be. She had to twist and turn in that direction to open up the channels of energy which have been blocked so that healing could take place. So if you tend to sort of move around with your head, you probably had some sort of little injury to your back or your shoulders. And all it is your body is telling you, this is how I need to be to get half an hour of healing, of energy flowing to where it needs. And from that time onwards, I've always trusted my body. If my body slumps, that's where it needs to be. If it leads over to this way, that's what must happen for the body to heal itself. And when people do this, they have this great experience after the meditation, let alone getting peaceful, they feel this incredible sense of relief, of locked in tensions in their body, which may have been in there for years. Another example, later on when I understood what was going on with meditation, a woman came up to me after meditation for her interview. She said it was a really weird meditation because I was meditating, my body wasn't moving, but my neck and shoulders got really hot. It was like a fever there. I just had this hot spot in my neck and shoulders. And then I told her, "When did you have your whiplash?" And she was stunned. "I always thought Ajahn Brahm had psychic powers. And now I found out you have. You've just read my mind. I never told you I had a car accident with whiplash. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu." I said, "Look, shut up." "I've been in this business a long time. I can add two and two to make four. What's the most common cause of shoulder and neck injuries? These car accidents when people get whiplash." And I said, "Look, I know that because all that heat was going up into your shoulders and neck, you must have had some injury up there, and now your body is healing it. And the most common injury is whiplash." So I guessed that and I got it right. It wasn't psychic powers, it was just experience and reason. And I said, "Because that you were relaxing, letting go of control of your body, that was the first time, probably since your accident, your body could really do some healing. You'd relaxed, you'd opened up, so channels of energy could now flow. And they were going to the place it was needed, in your neck and shoulders." I said, "You don't have to tell me, but if I had any money as a monk, which I don't, I could make a bet, and I'd be sure of winning, that you feel so much better afterwards." I said, "Yeah, I feel so relaxed in that area." So if you do have any hot spots in your body, that's what's happening. If it's at that stage in the meditation, around the delightful breath, when you're letting go of the body, you can't feel it too much. That's the time when you get hot spots in the body. And that is always healing energy. So you girls, if you have hot spots in your chest, don't be afraid. Brilliant. Incipient breast cancer has been stopped. If you have any other hot spots in your body, a lot of times the body knows where it needs to put some healing energy. But when you control, you're so tense and tight, you don't allow the body to heal itself.
All the doctors say that these diseases are stress produced. And when you let go of that stress, you get the healing happening. So if that ever happens to you, you get into that stage of meditation when you're really relaxed, just watching the beautiful breath, or even better, nimittas, and you can't feel your body, the body is just doing its own thing, and you feel later on a hot spot somewhere, brilliant. Delight in that. Something wonderful is happening. It's always healing energy focusing in a particular place and doing its job. So when you understand these things, you don't control, you let it happen, because this is all safe, 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 beneficial, beneficial, beneficial. And that way, not only are you healing your body and developing a peaceful mind, you're also getting these ordinary insights about how to have a healthy body. No, monks and nuns are not just happy people, they're usually healthy people as well. And they live a long life. Do you know right now, the oldest person in the world, according to the Guinness Book of Records, you know who that is? It's a monk in Penang. Not in Penang, in Phuket. 115 years of age. I think a few months ago, another elderly person, I think in the United States, passed away. And now this monk in Phuket is now officially, according to the Guinness Book of Records, the oldest person in the world. But does he live in an old people's home? No, he lives in his temple. So you can go and visit him, and he's really, really old, but he's still very clear, reasonably fit, and certainly, you know, he's not like many old people. And why is that? If you know how to meditate and relax, self-healing can happen, and you can be, if you want to be long-lived, fine, but long-lived and happy and clear as well. So these are the benefits of meditation. You have the insight in how to have a healthy, happy body. But of course the greatest insights is how to be free of the mental suffering. And that mental suffering in Buddhism, according to most people who know what they're talking about these days, is the biggest problem in the world. You may have a sick body, but if your mind is healthy, then you are fine. But if you have a healthy body and a sick mind, you're in big trouble. Over in places like Australia, there's a huge suicide rate. And these are healthy young men and women. They haven't got cancers, they haven't got heart disease. They've got fully healthy, fit bodies, but their boyfriends dumped them. Or they haven't done so well in the examinations. And that mental suffering is much more acute than any physical suffering. Hardly anyone commits suicide because of physical pain. 99% of people commit suicide because of mental pain. So that gives you an indication that when we come to suffering, the suffering inside is much, much, much worse than physical suffering. That's mental suffering is what you can't stand. Physical suffering is tough to bear, but you can bear it. Mental suffering is a killer. So it's not just having a healthy body. By learning about how to let go, you can overcome your mental suffering. For those of you who haven't read my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, there's one story which comes to mind. Again, happening in the time I was a monk in Thailand in a very remote forest when I had a very bad toothache. If you had a very bad toothache, you would just go and see a dentist this afternoon. But this was in the jungle. There wasn't a dentist in maybe 50 or 100 miles. Number two, there was no telephone or mobile phone. You couldn't ring anyone to make an appointment. There's not even a way to get there except by walking. And there wasn't even any Panadol or aspirin or painkiller. You were a monk. You were supposed to be tough. But sometimes those toothaches can be so bad that I asked dentists about this. They do. They have sent people crazy. So don't underestimate the power of pain, of a toothache. And
My toothache was so bad, there's no way I could sleep that night. At least so I thought. Just the whole jaw was throbbing, and it was just unendurable. So what did I do? I decided to meditate, to sit down and watch my breath. Breathing in, breathing, ow! And I couldn't stop it, the pain was too much. Now I do have a strong mind, I could endure 60 or 70 mosquitoes up on me at a time, but I could not endure that pain of a toothache. So I got up and tried walking meditation, because I couldn't sit. And after a few minutes I had to stop, because I was not doing walking meditation, I was doing running meditation. Because whenever you are in pain, you can't do anything slowly. I was running backwards and forwards. When that didn't work, I went back up into my hut and tried something else. Chanting. Now I already gave a whole talk about superstition. And I was not at all superstitious. I was a scientist. I did not believe in chanting. I thought it was just hocus pocus. But when you're desperate, you'll try anything. So I started chanting. And I had to stop that after 2 or 3 minutes, when I realized I was shouting at the top of my voice. And I'd wake up all the other monks. I was so desperate. And if you ever are in great pain, you can maybe understand what I mean. I just could not stand it any longer. And by that time, I'd exhausted all the possibilities of doing anything about it. Those are wonderful times in one's life. When one is so desperate, one cannot stand it any longer, but there's nothing you can do about it. And that's when I remembered the teachings of Ajahn Chah. I remember just two words, let go. And as I said earlier, all these teachings I give you now, you will remember them when they're really, really necessary. So I let go. Big time let go. And it was one of the most amazing experiences. That one second you're in unendurable pain, and the next moment the pain is totally gone and you're blissed out. Not even a second, half a second. I remember that experience, and it was shocking, but it was a great fun. You know, having this terrible, terrible, terrible pain, which you can't endure, and then the next moment it's not there anymore, and you're so blissed out, so happy, so peaceful. So I meditated, because that's, you know, what I thought I should do when I was blissing out. Crossed my legs and just went into a nice peaceful state. When he came out again afterwards, it's about 2 o'clock in the morning, and he had to get up at 3, so he just laid down and had a nap for half an hour, but very, very light nap, and then carried on as normal. But what I learned from that experience was not just the power of letting go, but something which the Buddha had said. He said that there are two types of pain, the physical pain and the mental pain. He said it's like two thorns or two arrows piercing you. And he said the physical pain you can't do much about, that's part of having a body. But the mental part of it, you can take that out whenever you want. And he said that the biggest part of that was the mental pain. I can't stand this any longer. I need to find a way out of here. Give me the Panadol. Give me the morphine. Do something. I can't stand it any longer. That's mental pain. And so when I let go, you took out the mental arrow of suffering. And what was left was negligible. Now that was a powerful insight about how to deal with what most people call unendurable pain. You can, when you know how to let go. So, you may not be in such great physical pain when you're meditating, but some of you are still in a lot of mental pain. This is so frustrating. I've been meditating here for 8 or 9 days. I'm getting nowhere. I bet everyone else has got jhana in this retreat, but not me. That sucks. I've seen all these other people, they've been sitting so straight, and I can't meditate for more than 10 or 15 minutes. Oh, I want to kill myself. I'm so depressed. I'm never going to come on a meditation. Maybe I'll become a Christian. It's easier. That's called mental pain. Now, please let go of that amount of mental pain. Just let it go. You're doing well. Let it be. The Buddha said, the stupid person who knows they're stupid, that's wise. So just let it be. And if you let it be, you take away the mental hour of suffering, then you start to bliss out. Because you know, there's lots of stories about people who got so frustrated when they're meditating. These are the stories I love telling at the end of a meditation retreat. And the first is this nun. What was her name again? I'll remember it in a minute. It wasn't Wajira. It must have been Wajira. This nun, she said, she wrote her story in the Terigata. Now, if any of you want to read some inspiring stories about real monks and real nuns in the time of the Buddha and what they went through to become enlightened, the Terigata and the Terigata, the verses of the elders, the elder monks and elder nuns. This is their stories, their little biographies of how they struggled and how they became enlightened eventually. And this one particular nun, she had been meditating as a nun for 7 long years. Not a 9-day retreat, but 7 years as a fully ordained bhikkhuni, as a nun. And after 7 years, she said she hadn't experienced one moment of peace in her meditation. It shows that, you know, nearly all of you, actually all of you, have done better than her. You've had moments of peace, maybe not as much as you would want, but you've had some nice meditations. As for her, 7 years, not one moment of peace. So she started thinking on her 7th anniversary of going forth. Obviously I can't meditate. Obviously this is not for me. But what's the alternative? Disrobing and going home? She said, that's like going home to the 3 crooked things. And those of you who don't know what the 3 crooked things were, this was a Pali term which many of the women who'd left home would describe. Said, when you leave home and become a nun, you leave behind the 3 crooked things. And the first crooked thing is the ladle, which you put into the curry. It's a symbol of cooking and all that work which women had to do in the kitchen. So the first crooked thing you left behind was the ladle. In other words, all cooking. So when you become a nun, you don't have to cook anymore. That's a relief. And the second crooked thing, which you leave behind when you become a nun, is the broom to sweep and clean the house. So that was a symbol of housework. So when you leave home as a nun, you leave behind the cooking and the housewife and the housework. And the third crooked thing was your husband. They were the 3 crooked things in Buddhism. And all the nuns, it was almost like a joke. But even the time of the Buddha, they had sensitive humor. So if you leave home and become a nun, remember you're leaving behind the 3 crooked things. Cooking, housework, and husband. He said, I don't want to go back to those 3 crooked things, but I can't stay as a nun, I've got no peace, so what should I do? So she got a length of rope. She went into the forest. She climbed a tree. She tied one end of the rope to a solid branch. The other end of the rope she tied around her neck, and she was about to jump off when she got enlightened. Just in time. I would not recommend that method. But why did she become enlightened? Because at that moment, when she was about to kill herself, jump off the tree, that's when she really let go. She stopped trying anymore. She abandoned all this trying to get enlightened or trying to get peaceful. Because that all that effort was what was stopping her for 7 years. She just gave up. I've had enough. I'm giving up. And that's when she became enlightened. I have many meditators who, when it gets to the last afternoon of the retreat, they haven't got anywhere in their meditation, so give up. 1 hour before 3 o'clock when we finish, what's the point? I'm not going to get anywhere. I might as well sit meditation anyway. So they sit meditation for the first time in the whole retreat, not trying to get somewhere. And have this beautiful meditation. Oh, this is really nice. Because they let go. Or the great story of Venerable Ananda. Think of this story. Ananda, the attendant of the Buddha, was with the Buddha as his attendant for 25 years. Sole personal access to the greatest teacher. Listening to all of these amazing teachings from the Buddha and great advice. Sitting by his side when he saw the Buddha giving advice to these monks and nuns and lay people, all becoming arahats and anagamis and having psychic powers. And Ananda, still a stream winner. Never got enlightened. And when the Buddha died, he was really upset. Buddha's died, I've been with him for 25 years, I never got enlightened. What chance is there now? So he really got quite depressed. However, a few months later, Mahakasapa, those of you who know the story, decided in order to preserve the Dhamma and the Vinaya, the monastic rules for posterity, let's make sure we all have a meeting together so we can collect all these teachings and make sure that they're all authenticated. So he called a meeting of 500 monks. 499 of them were fully enlightened. And the other one was Ananda. And the meeting was going to be tomorrow. It's just like I made the announcement that of you yogis, say 60 yogis who attended this retreat, 59 of you have got the jhanas and are fully enlightened, except for you. And you think, oh my goodness, everyone else is enlightened. Well, I'm the only one not to be enlightened. What would happen to you? You'd think, wow, this is unfair. I'm going to be the same as everybody else. You'd sit and put forth all of your effort to try and get enlightened. That's what Ananda did. He didn't want to be the odd monk out. The following morning, he was going to meet with 499 fully enlightened beings. And he was the odd one out. So he stayed up all night meditating. No sleep, no messing around. Meditate, meditate, meditate. When it came to dawn, nothing. No enlightenment, not even close. And so what did he do? He gave up trying to become enlightened. Instead, he went to bed. And as he lay down, according to the legend, before his head hit the pillow, he became fully enlightened with all of the psychic powers. It's called the Ananda method of enlightenment, going to bed. And it's one of the reasons I've encouraged you to go to bed so many times in this retreat. One of these days before you... No, the reason why he became enlightened is the interesting thing. Why did he become enlightened at that point? Because he'd been trying, 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 and now he totally gave up. He let go. And that's why he became enlightened. And if you want to know the best story to explain how this happens, I know many of you have heard his stories before, but this is one of the best ones. It's how the donkey catches the carrot. Because that's what meditation is like. That's what life is like. You're chasing the carrot. You're chasing peace. You're chasing nimittas. You're chasing jhanas and insight. But it's always just in front of you. You just can't get it. Just like the donkey carts. Donkeys are very stubborn. Just like your mind. You've been trying to train it all week and it doesn't respond. Like a donkey, you can whip it, you can beat it with a stick, and the donkey will not move. It's a very stubborn animal. So the only way you can get a donkey to move is you take that stick, but don't hit it. You take that stick and tie it to the donkey's back. So the front of the stick is about 2 feet in front of the donkey's face. You tie a string to the end of a stick and a carrot to the end of the string. So the donkey sees a nice carrot in front of its mouth, only 2 feet away. So the donkey moves towards the carrot. But because the stick is tied to the carrot, the stick moves with the donkey, the string moves, and so the carrot moves. So as the donkey moves forward, so does the carrot. But the donkey may be stubborn, but it's very stupid. So even though the carrot keeps moving, so does the donkey, thinking it can catch that carrot. And that's the way the donkey pulls the cart. Because it always thinks it's going to catch the carrot, but never does. And that's like meditation for you. Sometimes, if it's delightful breath, peace, it's almost there. Just move a little bit forward and you'll get it. Nimittas, sometimes they get flashy. Just a bit more and I'll catch it. Insight, enlightenment. You have these wonderful insights, but it's not quite enlightenment. You keep moving and so does the carrot. And for many people, that's the story of your life. Whether it's happiness and fulfillment, wealth in life, it's almost within reach, and when you move to catch it, it goes 2 feet in front of you again. However, the donkey who went to Ajahn Brahm's retreat learned how to catch the carrot. So what does the donkey do? The donkey runs like hell after that carrot. Doesn't matter how fast the donkey runs, the carrot moves at exactly the same speed. Always 2 feet in front. In this simile, you have been trying hard, even though I tried to tell you not to. You've been running after the carrot of enlightenment. And it comes to the end of the retreat, you give up. Hopeless, I'm not going to get enlightened. I'm not going to stop trying. The donkey stops. And when the donkey stops, the carrot moves further away. It moves further and further away until it's about 4 feet in front of the donkey's mouth. But at that point, something strange happens. Now the carrot starts moving towards the donkey. And what does the donkey do? Nothing. Stands absolutely still. And a few minutes later, the carrot is 2 feet in front of the donkey's mouth, as it normally is. But this time it's coming at great speed towards the donkey. And what does the donkey do? Just patience, let's go, be still. And then the carrot comes right close to the donkey's mouth, and the last instructions it remembers, the door of my mouth is open to you. And the carrot comes into the donkey's mouth. That's how Ananda became enlightened, how that nun became enlightened. They've been running, 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 and then they stopped. They gave up. Jump off the tree with a rope on my neck. I'm just going to lay down, have a bit of a break and rest. And when you stop chasing the carrot, that's when the carrot, first of all, moves further away, but then it starts coming towards you. And that's how people become enlightened. That's how they get jhanas. chasing jhanas day after day after day, never getting anywhere, and then they stop and the jhana comes towards you. That's nice. So these are stories talking about the same thing from so many different angles of what this meditation is all about. Soon this retreat is going to finish, and soon you're going to go home again. And in your home, you're going to try and meditate. You'll be very diligent, maybe for the first week, maybe only the first few days, and then you forget all about it and be life back to normal again. But nevertheless, seeds have been planted in your mind. You've learned so much. Even though you may not have understood it yet, you've learned so much. And it's only a matter of time before all those instructions, you try them, you put them into practice, and soon that you'll find how easy meditation is. You sit down there and you know how to fully let go. And that is a skill which is probably will be considered the best thing you ever learned in your whole life. There will come times in life of pain. You can just let go and the mental pain finishes, ends. It's so easy to bear. There'll be times of great disappointment and frustration when you're treated so unfairly. You can just let go. There are times when you really need to rest and relax. You can just let go. There was that story I told at the beginning of the retreat of the German man here in Malaysia who had a heart attack. He really let go when he knew what was happening. And 30 minutes of not breathing had no deleterious effect on his brain or on his health. Perfectly healthy afterwards. Called me up to say thank you for teaching me how to let go, to save him from brain damage. And how did he do that? He was just like you when you meditate, trying to let go but getting nowhere. When it really matters, you'll find you'll do it, and you'll be so surprised. So all of these teachings have a huge benefit, and you will notice them. And for those of you later on, after you've let the practice disappear and go, the next time there's a retreat, you'll pick up from where you left off. Don't think that if you don't keep practicing, you lose everything. That doesn't work that way. Even if you hardly meditate at all between now and the next retreat, you come on the next retreat and soon you'll be back to where you left off. The mind remembers, even though it stores it away and the file is dusty, it still remembers. So you never lose anything. You just put it aside for a short while and it's there for you later on. And after a while, when you know this meditation, with skill, with practice, it gets better and better and better. And then you too will be a happy yogi. Whatever happens to you in life, you have this beautiful resource of stillness and peace and letting go inside. And that will keep you safe, happy and at peace. And eventually it will just build and build and build in its time. Give you the jhanas, give you stream winning, give you enlightenment. You'll understand all the teachings of the Buddha because you'd experience them for yourselves. Going against the stream of craving. Letting go. Kindness. Contentment. Stillness. The path to enlightenment. Thank you for listening. So, any comments or questions about this last formal talk? There's another talk this afternoon at 3 o'clock. That's the last formal talk. Okay, so there's another couple of 2.5. You got a question? Yeah, go on. A simple person and an intellect, which will be a better person and why? I'm going to put that another way. Woman, man, who is the best meditator? I've been teaching meditation a long time now, and the girls have an easier time getting into jhanas. You are better at becoming still. However,
once you become still and get into jhanas, it takes you a longer time to get insight into what they really mean. Men takes a longer time getting into the jhanas. Once you get there, you're very sharp and you get insight and you catch up with the girls. The intellects, this is a complete generalization. There are many, many exceptions. But the intellect helps you to gain the insight, but stops you getting the peace and the jhanas. So if you have a simple person where you're just more emotionally connected, rather, more in your heart rather than in your head, you find an easier time meditating, but a faster time getting insight. So it all balances out in the end. So you girls, you have more chance getting jhana than the guys. But once you get the jhanas, the guys are going to catch up with you. That's generally speaking, it's not always the case. Okay, so there's interviews down below, and remember, it's only 2.5 hours before lunch, so it's a waste of time trying to get enlightened. So there's no chance you're going to get jhanas. So just give up. I think you get the message. Okay, see you later.